KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Most Americans don't question an individual's right to own a gun, with certain exceptions. In an age when senseless public shootings make frequent headlines, many question the limits of gun ownership. And though a large majority of Americans say they're for expanded background checks, Congress can't come to any agreement on possible legislation. Here in Washington state, there are competing initiatives on the November ballot. One would expand background checks, the other limit them. But what exactly is our right to gun ownership? The Second Amendment reads as follows: a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The wording of the Second Amendment left a wake of confusion and disagreement in American political history. But a 2008 Supreme Court decision, District of Columbia v. Heller, which for the first time recognized an individual's right to own a gun, raised the focus of the debate. In his new book, The Second Amendment, a biography, author Michael Waldman attempts to clarify the murky history of that debate in those 27 words. Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University School of Law. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on July 7th, 2014, as part of their Civics series. Thanks to Anna Tatasheff for this recording.
Thank you so much for being here in this warm evening. We'll try to heat it up even more. It is really, really wonderful to be here at Town Hall. This institution, these conversations are well known all over the country for keeping the intellectual juices flowing, for being a really critical part of the debate, and I'm really honored to be able to join with all of you. And thank you, Edward, for the introduction. I've had other introductions I didn't like quite as much. As he mentioned, I was President Bill Clinton's chief speechwriter once after a State of the Union address I'd worked on. I was especially proud of the work I'd done. I was talking to someone after the speech, and he came over and put his arm around me, and he said, "This is Michael. He's the guy who typed my speech." So I like that introduction better. It was accurate, but not complete. And you all are very, very lucky, as I hope you know, to get to hear tomorrow from Eric Liu, who was a policy aide as well as a foreign policy and domestic policy aide and advisor and thinker as well as speechwriter for President Clinton, and has continued to help shape the way we all think about citizenship and the economy and so many other things. As Edward mentioned, I wear several hats, and I am the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. And the Brennan Center is a law and policy institute, a nonpartisan organization that focuses on reforming and improving the systems of democracy and justice. And our premise is, if you want to solve the problems, you have to fix the systems. We were started by the clerks and family of Justice Brennan when he left the Supreme Court 2 decades ago. We take some of our mission from his spirit that the Constitution should protect human dignity as a central value. We're deeply engaged in the fight to protect voting rights. Our work saved the right to vote for as many as 5 million people in the last election, for campaign finance laws to curb the corrosive power of big money, for common sense bipartisan reform on criminal justice, where there are some really exciting opportunities bringing together left and right to deal with mass incarceration, a whole host of issues. And so we have at the front, sign up if you're interested in receiving any of the emails and publications we churn out. We're eager to keep in touch. So please feel free to sign up. No spam, only voluntary sign-ups sought. As part of the work we do, what I try to understand is how we, the people, how we Americans, grapple with and shape our Constitution, this remarkable document, this remarkable set of principles that we think about in this country so much more than other people in other countries think about their charter. And of course, this topic of the Second Amendment is one of the most burning, controversial, contentious, and current debates around the Constitution today and for a long time, although interesting, not always, throughout the country's history. And I wanted to understand, in writing this book, how does legal change actually happen in America? How does constitutional change happen? How do we understand what that Constitution means? And how do we all play a role in shaping it? And as I'm sure you all know, the Second Amendment is only 27 words long. It's the shortest sentence in the Constitution. It reads, a well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, comma, shall not be infringed. 27 words. What a lot of people don't know, even people who care passionately about this issue, don't realize, is that the Supreme Court never ruled that the Second Amendment recognized an individual right to gun ownership until 2008. 2008, it was really recent. In fact, previously, repeatedly, they'd ruled otherwise. And Justice Antonin Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion, I'm hearing some noise, but some feedback in the sound system. I love to talk about it. They'd ruled otherwise repeatedly. And Justice Scalia, the author of the majority opinion in District of Columbia versus Heller, he was very proud of the opinion, and he said it reflected, it was the apogee, the vindication, he said, of his approach of originalism, that the only legitimate way to understand a constitutional provision is to ask what it meant to the framers and what it meant to their generation. And that's the way to do it. And this was his big opportunity to use that approach, and he saw it as the vindication. So looking at the history, looking at how we've looked at the Second Amendment, turned out to be pretty relevant to understanding it. And there were, to me, surprises at every step of the way. Surprises for people who consider themselves advocates of gun rights, and surprises for people who consider themselves advocates of gun control or gun safety laws. The story is twists and turns, and not necessarily what you expect. And the thing that turned out to be the case, at least in my reading of it, is that the way we Americans have understood the Second Amendment has never been about some pristine text. It's always been the push and pull of public agitation, political organizing, and public debate. That's always the way it's been from the beginning. In fact, that's the way it always is with all constitutional provisions. And it's always been the case when it comes to the Second Amendment that, to a surprising degree, individual rights and individual responsibility have gone hand in hand from the beginning, from back to the founding era. So what were some of those surprises? What is that story? Why is it called a biography of the Second Amendment? Well, the story starts, at least where I started, way back in the East Coast, in the hills 16 miles outside of Boston, at Lexington and Concord, when the militias of those towns and of Massachusetts first did battle with King George's troops and fired the shot heard round the world, although we actually don't know who fired the shot. Somebody fired the shot heard round the world and launched the American Revolution. Because that was pretty important, as it happens, to the story of the Second Amendment, because that was those Minutemen, that was the militia. And it turns out that to the framers, when you want to look at what they were focused on when they wrote that Second Amendment, the framers cared passionately about those militias. It was not, to them, throat-clearing, the way we sort of imagine it might be now when we look at the part, the second half of the amendment, which is what we focus on so much. What were the militias? They were not like anything we know now. They were not like anything we have now. It wasn't the same as the National Guard, which we sort of think of as the grandchildren of the of those militias. The militia of the colonial era and the revolutionary era, every adult man, eventually every adult white man, was in the militia for their entire adult life, from age 16 to 60. And they were required by law to own a gun and to keep it at home and to bring it in for the militia service. This was sort of a proto-democracy. It was the way people participated in the civic life of their community. There were no police forces. There was no army. There was basically no cities. This was how people participated. And the militias were not just this kind of military force, but it was really at the heart of a political philosophy that was very important to the framers and to the revolutionaries of America. They thought not only were these valuable, but they were a bulwark against tyranny. They were the way to protect, to check the power of what they feared more than anything else, which was a standing army. What was a standing army? Well, the King George's Redcoats, that was a standing army. Standing army was a professional military force, paid, commanded by the king, that could be an agent of authoritarianism. And there was a whole political philosophy about militias and endless discussion of how important the militias were. Now, the reality was sometimes a little different. They fought well at Lexington and Concord. They didn't fight so well, actually, during the rest of the Revolution. There were people like George Washington who grew pretty cynical pretty quickly about the militias, who actually thought our new country needed an army. But the public reverence for the militias was really strong. When the Revolution ended, the British sailed away. The country, as we know, faced a lot of issues of military power, but it also began to fall apart. It began to drift toward what we would now call a failed state during the Articles of Confederation period. So during time of violence, of mob violence and Shays' Rebellion, as we all learned in high school history, and where a mob in western Massachusetts refused to obey the orders of the courts, and the militia was sent by the governor, and they took a vote and switched sides. The militia members elected their officers, and they took a vote before going into battle. The leading men of the states went behind closed doors in Philadelphia and held what we call now, of course, the Constitutional Convention, and debated quite considerably these issues of military power and what we should do with the militias, with these revered institutions of citizen soldiers keeping their weapons, their personal weapons. How should that fit into the new order of the Constitution? So when the Constitution got released, you all know, it thrust much more strongly toward a more powerful central government. And when it was released to the public, it was wildly controversial. It was perhaps the greatest debate we've ever had in this country, as people argued for and against. Many, many Americans were really afraid that this new government was going to be tyrannical. And one of the things they were afraid of was that it allowed there to be a standing army, and that they were afraid that that standing army could crush those 13 state militias made up of citizen soldiers with their guns from home. And that was one of the things they were debating. And as you know, when the Constitution rolled from state to state getting ratified, what wound up happening was eventually it got ratified by every state, but after about halfway through, people said, well, we're going to ratify it, but we want you to do some amendments. And states sent in dozens and dozens of contradictory amendments on all different kinds of topics, only a few of them touching on the militia. But this was the way they got it passed. And that fear of those militias being crushed by the new government was what led directly to the Second Amendment.
Stay tuned for more about the Second Amendment with writer Michael Waldman. Coming up, how James Madison was against amendments before he was for them. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien.
21 minutes past 9, 94.9 KUOW. Marijuana grow operations have alarm systems, dozens of cameras, and tall fences obscured to outside views. Growers have to comply with a variety of security measures, but some say they aren't worried about theft and violence. Should they be? A report tomorrow at noon on KUOW's The Record. Support for KUOW comes from Providence, founded in Washington 158 years ago. The not-for-profit healthcare system is committed to delivering quality healthcare across the West Coast, including $951 million in charity care and community benefit. More at providence.org.
This is Lakshmi Singh. Renewing members are some of KUOW and NPR's most important sources of support. If you recently received a renewal notice, please mail it back or renew online at kuow.org. And thanks from all of us.
Forecast for the Seattle area for tonight. Lows 50s to lower 60s, partly cloudy. Friday highs in the 70s, cloudy in the morning, then becoming partly sunny. Looking ahead to Friday night, lows in the 50s, partly cloudy. Saturday highs up to near 80 degrees, sunny skies.
Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Now, back to deciphering the fog of history with Michael Waldman, author of The Second Amendment, a biography.
James Madison played a really interesting role. I had a lot of fun learning or relearning the story of Madison as one of the founders and fathers of our constitutional system. He, of course, was the mind behind our system of government. He took the notes at the Constitutional Convention. He organized the campaign along with the other young men who had served mostly in the army, not in the militia, who were pushing for the new Constitution. He, of course, co-authored with Hamilton and Jay the Federalist Papers, all of which argued we shouldn't amend the Constitution. And then he ran for Congress in the very first congressional election. And his bitter, bitter political archenemy, Patrick Henry, had it in for Madison. He gerrymandered the district. This was 20 years before Elbridge Gerry signed his name to a district and gave us gerrymandering. They gerrymandered Madison before Gerry. The only part of his congressional district that was pro-Constitution was basically his house. He was bookish and diffident and an intellectual. They ran against him a not-too-bright war hero with a British musket ball in his lung, James Monroe, who was against the Constitution and wanted amendments. And it turned out that the farmers of that district would definitely rather drink a cider with Monroe than with Madison in today's terms. And it turned out that the swing vote made all the difference. The swing vote in that district were the Southern Baptists. Now, today, of course, Southern Baptists are a reliably conservative voting bloc. Then they were the religious dissidents, and they felt that they had been oppressed by the Episcopalians of their district. It's actually true. They taxed them. And so they said to Madison, we'll vote for you, but only if you switch your position on amendments and come out for a religious freedom amendment. So James Madison, who was against, as we would say, today, he was against the Bill of Rights before he was for it. Madison executed the first great flip-flop in American political history, issued this statement about how, well, it's true, I was always against amendments, but things have really changed now, and I really meant it all. My position is completely consistent now with what it was, the opposite, last week, and tens of thousands of politicians have followed that approach since. I work for a few. And I won't say which ones. And he switched his position, came out for amendments, vowed, made a read-my-lips promise to pass them, and he won by 339 votes. Then he got to Congress, so then he had to go pass the Bill of Rights. And he got to Congress, and nobody cared, because they'd all gotten elected saying no amendments. And for Madison and the other members of Congress, it was something of a sop to the public. Madison eventually argued, saying this was necessary, these amendments were necessary to deal with the psychological distemper of the public that was irrationally fearful of all this stuff. He got up, and June 8th of 1789, he proposed 20 amendments 20 amendments, not the 10 amendments like the Decalogue that we know now. They ranged in topic from the size of congressional districts to congressional pay to this amendment dealing with military power, as well as the it was the Fifth Amendment, and also the amendment next to it dealing with the quartering of troops and homes, and the other things, of course, that we know of as the Bill of Rights. It was debated. They marked it up. It was written more or less by Madison's approach was taken. It went into committee. It was Congress. We don't have C-SPAN, but it wasn't all very pretty. And they came out eventually with the 10 amendments now that we now know. And they were sent off to the states for ratification. And there's almost no evidence of any debate after that. We can find very little evidence of them even talking about the Second Amendment or the other parts of the Bill of Rights as they were ratified. So what did they mean? What was clear to me in reading and writing about this was, given the theory that you're supposed to draw your understanding of the Constitution based now on what they meant then, was that a lot of them meant different things. And there's the fog of history. It's really hard to know what they meant. But the fact of the matter is this, and this is striking given our intense debates today on individual gun rights. There, if you look at the notes from the Constitutional Convention, if you look with a few scattered exceptions at the records of the ratification conventions, if you look at the debate in the Congress over the Second Amendment, and 12 members of the House of Representatives spoke about it, there is not a word about an individual right to gun ownership for the things we think about now, self-protection, hunting, or other things like that. It was all focused on the political check involved in the militias. In fact, Madison's original proposal for the Second Amendment had a conscientious objector clause. It said if you are religiously scrupulous of bearing arms, you don't have to do your military service in person. That's what they were debating. So it's really striking as we try to look for answers for these debates today. It's very hard to find it. Now, I want to be very clear. It's very important. Certainly, people ask this question a lot. There were a lot of guns in the United States, in the colonies and in the United States then. And Americans believed they had a right to use them. They believed they had a right to self-defense, especially in the home. This was a right handed down from England through common law. And if you read the great jurist Blackstone, he talks about the right of self-defense as being very important. But as a common law right, it was subject to limitations also. And there were, it turns out, a web of gun control laws, even in the colonies, even in the early American period. In Boston, it was illegal to keep a loaded gun in your home for safety reasons. In Philadelphia and other cities, you couldn't fire a gun in the city limits. Lots of states prohibited different kinds of people from having guns, people who were considered unusually dangerous, Tories, for example. There were all kinds of, you had to take a loyalty oath, all kinds of restrictions on gun ownership and gun practice, which were seen then as completely consistent with the right of self-defense, which was, again, a common law right, and not what they were debating, at the least based on the record, not what they were talking about and debating when they talked about putting the Second Amendment in the Constitution. That is, in many respects, a surprise. Something funny happened right after that. That militia system, what they were so passionate about, what they memorialized, what they debated in the Constitutional Convention, what they memorialized in the Constitution, it started to crumble, started to fade away. What happened? People stopped showing up for militia duty. They 2 months after the Second Amendment was ratified, Congress passed a law requiring every white man to buy a gun. No one would do it because it was government telling me what to do. It was actually cited in the Obamacare case in front of the Supreme Court as another example where government ordered people to buy something in private commerce. The country changed. People started to realize the militias were not such a great instrument of defense. the War of 18, James Madison in Federalist Number 46 had written about the armed citizenry, and the militias would be 500,000 strong and could protect the country. And then the British invaded during the War of 1812, brushed right past the Maryland militia, and burned down James Madison's house, at the White House. And then after that, they stopped thinking the militias were going to be enough to protect the country. And the country changed too. It grew much more into the country we are today. It grew more individualistic. People didn't see their civic duty as being at the heart, but they saw their individual rights as being more paramount. I'm asked all the time, does it, when you look at the founding era, does it reflect an individual right or the militia? And the answer is both and neither. It reflected an individual right to fulfill the civic duty to serve in the militia. So our question to the founders would make no sense, just like their answer in many ways makes no sense. But then the country changed. It grew more individualistic. There were greater understanding that there would be gun rights and always this sense of individual responsibility and gun laws at the same time. Even in the Wild West, there's a wonderful photograph of Dodge City, Kansas, the archetypal Wild West town. It looks like it's in a movie. It's from the 1880s. It looks like you're at the Universal Studios back lot, you know, for the Western set. It's dusty Main Street, and the saloon doors on both sides, and the hitching posts, and says, "Welcome to Dodge City. Firearms strictly prohibited." Dodge City. But the country changed, and a lot of states changed, too. What we understood the right to be changed from this kind of civic right to an individual right. States that joined later, that was more explicit. Washington State, it was more explicit. The Constitution in Washington State is one of the only constitutions that explicitly refers to individual rights of gun ownership, as opposed to much more ambiguous. The early constitutions were clearly about a more collective right. Washington State refers to an individual right, and so do some of the other recent ones. But Washington sort of is quite distinct in that way. But all along, throughout most of the country, you had individual gun rights and gun ownership and gun laws. And the courts stayed out. The courts stayed out. Four times the Supreme Court looked at the Second Amendment. And four times it declined to rule that it recognized an individual right to gun ownership. In 1939, 9-0. And that was the status quo. These issues of gun rights and gun responsibilities were debated in Congress, they were debated in legislatures, at the ballot box, in the public debate, but it wasn't something where people thought they had the ability to go to court and get a judge to overturn a law based on a reading of a constitutional amendment. The conventional wisdom, the consensus of the time, was articulated by the former Chief Justice of the United States, Warren Burger, rock-ribbed conservative appointed by Richard Nixon. In 1991, Burger said, "The idea that the Second Amendment recognizes an unlimited right to individual gun ownership is, quote, a fraud on the public." Warren Burger said that. That sounds like from ancient days, right? So what happened? What happened? What changed? That comes to the second surprise. What changed is the role of the NRA. The NRA, we all know that the NRA is an extremely effective force at the ballot box and in political debate. It turns out that the NRA, along with other groups, including the Second Amendment Foundation here in Bellevue, are critical constitutional players as well. Now, the NRA was... it's been around for a long time. It was created after the Civil War by Union officers who were concerned that the Union troops had poor marksmanship, and they wanted to train them better. And it focused for a long time on training, on safety, on preparedness. It kind of wound up speaking for hunters and sportsmen. On the headquarters in Washington, D.C., on the wall outside, it had big letters about safety and training and sportsmanship. Then came 1977, and it turns out we all think about the massive social changes from the 1960s and the impact that they had. It turns out that the backlash to the 1960s in the 1970s in some ways is more important and is what we're living with now. The NRA had never been wild about gun laws, but it hadn't really done much to oppose them either. It actually testified for the first federal gun law in the 1930s when asked by a member of Congress, is there a provision in the Constitution? Do you see any constitutional problem with any of this? The NRA representative said, none that we can think of. What happened? In 1977, the NRA made clear, after supporting some recent gun laws, that it was going to move its headquarters to Colorado to further signal a further retreat from politics. At the convention that year, it's known as the Revolt at Cincinnati, activists, about 1,000 activists, many from the Second Amendment Foundation, but others as well, showed up, voted out the old leadership, voted in new leadership that was much more intense, much more ideological, much more doctrinaire, and emphatically focused on remaking the NRA as a constitutional crusade for this vision of the Second Amendment. And now, when you go to the NRA headquarters in Virginia, you go into the lobby, and there on the wall, in pride of place, is the text of the Second Amendment. But you have to look closely. It's edited. They just edited out the first half, the part about the well-regulated militia. There's two dots. There's not even three dots. There's two dots. And what the NRA and other gun rights advocates did was kind of wage a classic constitutional campaign. They started with scholarship to show what had really been meant. What did they really mean? What was the legacy from England of gun rights? Now, some of the scholarship was strong, and some of it I found, at least, to be quite flimsy. A lot of plucking of quotes from the founding fathers out of context in a way that would be familiar to the people who write movie posters. You know, one, but only one example, Thomas Jefferson. There's numerous law review articles take this quote from Thomas Jefferson. He says, "One loves to possess arms, the one hopes to never have to use them." Wow, that's a good one. This is supposed to show you what the Second Amendment meant to the framers. And you can still see that on the NRA website. You can buy a T-shirt with it. Well, but it's all online now, though. So you go and look and see what did Jefferson really say. He was writing to George Washington. He said, "Mr. President, remember that decision I made as Secretary of State that was so controversial? I think I'm going to get attacked for it. Could you send me back that batch of letters I gave you? I need to be prepared to respond. One loves to possess arms, but one hopes never to have to use them." Whoops. It turns out it was a metaphor. But you can still see it on the website or buy the T-shirt or find it in law review articles. There was way too much of that. That wasn't all. The gun rights community worked very hard to change public opinion so that it became the conventional, the consensus view that, of course, the Second Amendment refers to an individual right. It elected politicians, of course, or held them accountable, changed the organs of government so that the Justice Department switched its position of decades in 2001 to say, no, in fact, the Second Amendment refers to an individual right. And then, and only then, did they go to court. So that when that case was finally brought up before the Supreme Court in 2008, it fell like a ripe apple from a tree. Wasn't even really all that controversial. And that is, by the way we make constitutional change in America. That's how the civil rights movement did it. It's how marriage equality is sweeping across the country right now. It's how groups like mine work on voting rights. It's how people I'm fighting against got us Citizens United and other cases from the Supreme Court that changed the doctrine a lot. They understood that it was important to win in the court of public opinion before you win in the court of law. So that was the story. That is the constitutional story. And then there was another surprise after that. What happened next? What happened next, in some ways, what we're living through now, is an even bigger surprise. So the Heller case, when you strip away all the finery of its originalism, and Scalia, I'm very critical of the case and how it was written and its pretense. And of the 64 pages in the majority opinion, two deal with what the framers actually were talking about, which was the militias. The rest takes the words keep and bear and arms out of order and out of context and looks at dictionaries and says, what does it mean in a dictionary from this period and that period? To me, it read like a Scrabble player trying really hard to prove that triple score word really does exist. You know, and It's been criticized a lot by other judges, by conservative judges, who thought it was kind of loosey-goosey constitutionalism that they used to criticize liberals for doing. But when you strip away the originalism, what did the Supreme Court actually say? What it said was this. Yes, there's an individual right. But that right, like all rights, has limitations. That right, like all rights, implies responsibilities. And so there can be gun restrictions, gun laws, gun controls, and the opinion by Justice Scalia lists a bunch of them. Now, the court was kind of vague about what the right was. It was kind of vague about what the restrictions might be. It's thrown the question out to other judges and other courts. There have been dozens and dozens and dozens of lawsuits all across the country since 2008. And the overwhelming consensus is that these laws have been upheld against these challenges by federal judges all across the country. Yes, they say there's an individual right, but society, too, has a right to protect itself. There is a compelling governmental and public interest in strong gun laws. Now, not everywhere has had that ruling. In fact, one of the most controversial topics is being debated right now, actually in this federal judicial circuit, the question of how far does the Second Amendment extend to guns carried outside the home? The Supreme Court has never ruled on whether either concealed carrying or open carrying is constitutionally protected. Almost all the courts have upheld gun laws very, very strictly limiting carrying of weapons. Interestingly, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the most liberal circuit in the country, struck down California's gun law a few months ago in a case called Peruta. And that applies to this state and other states as well on the West Coast. It's probably the case that the full group of judges in the Ninth Circuit is going to hear that again. It could well be that that case goes up to the Supreme Court. But interestingly, most recently, 2 weeks ago, the justices have been very, very reluctant to hear another big gun case. No one knows why. Maybe they think that the consensus that's developed is something they like. Maybe nobody knows how Justice Kennedy's going to vote, which is very possibly what the challenge is. Nobody knows. But they turn down opportunities to hear these cases. And many gun rights advocates have decried these judicial decisions, have said that they follow the reasoning of the dissent in Heller more than the opinion, have likened this consensus of these dozens of rulings to massive resistance, to the South's resistance to Brown versus Board of Education during the Civil Rights era. But that is one of the surprising and fascinating facts.
Stay tuned for more surprising facts with this week's guest, author Michael Waldman. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
16 minutes before 10, KUOW 94.9. Later tonight, we're going to hear a conversation with a woman in San Francisco who uses a GPS-linked running app on her phone that tracks her when she jogs, which she's been using to make drawings with her running routes. And wait till you hear what those drawings are of. It's part of As It Happens tonight at 11. Support for KUOW comes from the Everett Clinic with comprehensive heart and vascular centers in both Everett and Smoky Point, offering screening, diagnosis, and technologically advanced treatment options. More at everettclinic.com/heart. Lows 50s to lower 60s tonight, says the forecast for the Seattle area. Partly cloudy. Friday highs in the 70s. Cloudy in the morning, then becoming partly sunny. Hear Dina Kaye talk about the career of her father, multi-talented entertainer and humanitarian Danny Kaye, beginning in a few minutes at 10 o'clock.
Welcome back to the last segment of tonight's Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Coming up, how gun rights change may actually come about.
Another surprising and fascinating fact has to do with the real-world political impact of this newly enshrined constitutional right. After the Newtown massacre, the horrific murder of those children in late 2012, the country once again began debating gun laws for the first time in almost two decades. And that was when I started writing the book after that. And the Congress, as you know, debated strengthening the background check system, the federal background check system. It was a bipartisan bill called Manchin-Toomey. It had a majority of the Senate, but it failed to overcome a filibuster. That proposal did not lose because it was decried or effectively debunked as violating the Second Amendment. Nobody really seriously argued that it violated the Second Amendment because the court had been so clear that the wrong kind of people, dangerous people, can be kept from getting guns, and that laws can be effective to do that. It lost because of the political power of the NRA and other gun rights advocates. It lost because of the filibuster rule. It actually had a majority of the Senate. It didn't lose because of the Second Amendment. And there are actually people who say, well, this ruling by the Supreme Court will make it easier to get a consensus because there's an individual right. No one's going to take everyone's guns away. But we can also have restrictions. We can also have gun laws. There's another set of factors that suggest there might be eventually moves, even on this tense and intense issue, toward that kind of common sense consensus. You know, as you all know, there's almost 300 million guns in the United States. Much, much, much more than any other developed country. Nobody's going to take those guns away. Nobody's going to take those guns away, even if they wanted to. The number of guns is going up, but the ranks of gun owners is going down pretty dramatically. Fewer and fewer people have more and more guns. And fewer people, for example, are hunting. And the other longstanding purposes why people have guns. And so one can imagine that there are ways that this could ease as an issue. I was really struck, because a lot of the things that could actually make a difference to keep children from accidentally shooting themselves or others, to keep guns out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them, there are technological changes, there are technological fixes, there are legal approaches that don't come close to touching the Second Amendment that actually turn out to be things that can make a big difference. I was really struck 2 weeks ago by a statistic I heard, and this isn't in the book because it was much more recent. This year, for the first time, more Americans will be killed by firearms than by cars. 33,000 people. Now, at one level, that's a terrifying and horrifying statistic. Again, it's multiples more than other equally violent countries in Europe and elsewhere. But what's really interesting is actually why so few people are killed by cars. The number of people killed by cars is going down and down and down. Why is that? Cars used to kill a lot more people. Well, they didn't seize the cars. They didn't confiscate your car. They didn't take away your right to drive. They made cars safer. They put in airbags. They put in seat belts over the strenuous objection of the auto industry, but they did those things. They raised the drinking age. They lowered the speed limit. They put in all these sensors, that video camera in the back of the car that everybody now sees. I mean, all these things made cars safer. There are similar technological things that can help make guns safer. And so what I worry about is the idea that Second Amendment fundamentalism, the idea that somehow a misremembered history tells us that no restriction is ever permissible on any use of firearms or any ownership of firearms, and that you can go to a judge to enforce that can sideswipe and defeat the ability to reach toward that common ground. What is it that needs to be done? Part of what I argue in the end of the book is I think that one of the answers has to be who makes the decisions. I think that the people, that the right of the people as described in the amendment, that we the people in the preamble of the Constitution, we're the ones who always have decided what the Constitution means. The way the Second Amendment changed, the way the courts changed, as with all this other constitutional change we've seen, was always, again, a matter of public debate, public argument, public organizing at the ballot box in referendums like the ones we're seeing here in Washington State and elsewhere. That, to me, is the answer. People who want stronger gun laws, they ask me, what should they do? I say, take a page from the NRA and the other gun rights advocates. Be in it for the long haul. Understand that you have to win in the court of public opinion before you're going to win in the court of law. Take the cue from Abraham Lincoln, one of the great constitutional thinkers in our history, a great lawyer. He was arguing in the first Lincoln-Douglas debate in 1858. He was talking, of course, about slavery. And he said, with public sentiment, anything is possible. Without public sentiment, nothing is possible. Consequently, he who molds public sentiment has more power than a judge or a legislator, because they make it possible for those judges or legislators to act. That's how the gun issue has been, is, and will be debated and decided. So thank you for your patience. I'm eager to hear any questions or conversations.
I want to ask you a question of constitutional law when you were talking about originalism. I'm curious about the fact that, if I heard you right, the framers of the Constitution didn't get into the issue, as I heard it, of individual gun ownership because it was assumed that people had a right to go hunting and have a gun in their home. So my question is, when people debate the Constitution or the Supreme Court, do they ever take into account the context of the times and why things may or may not be in the Constitution, and there may be certain things that people take as a right that were a right then that were never put in the Constitution because everyone thought that, why bother?
That's a good question, and that question is premised on the argument in the way Justice Scalia, for example, would see it in many respects. There were a lot of things that were seen as rights in those days that they didn't think they were putting in the Constitution. And those rights, as I said, came from common law. They came from court decisions and common practice. And it evolved and changed over time. And so there were plenty of rights, such as the right to own property is not actually mentioned in the Constitution, but they thought they had the right to own property, including other people. And they also knew that there could be restrictions on that property ownership through nuisance laws and other things, and that was not in the Constitution. So they were actually pretty careful about what they thought they were putting in the Constitution and what they thought they were leaving out. It doesn't mean that they thought that they were blotting out things, but they didn't think that they were putting the right to hunt in the Second Amendment. Again, I do urge folks to really look. They really were talking about it as a matter of political power to check the danger of untrammeled federal power. It was kind of a federalism checks and balances issue. Again, the militia was not anything we have now. It was citizen soldiers with private arms. But what they were focused about, what they felt was important enough to put in the Constitution, was that political purpose of gun ownership.
Okay, I may have a partial answer just then, but my question is about Scalia and his approach, his originalism approach, which I've heard many times. I've never heard it explained by him, and I would assume that if he thought that that 2008 decision was basically the apex of his concept of originalism, he might have, you know, gone through some sort of justification with respect to what the framers of our Constitution said. But in your research and your book, you point out that there really wasn't any discussion at all. So did Scalia make any attempt at all to justify why this was such a great example of originalism, or is it just dogma on his part?
He's on the speaking circuit quite a lot, and he's very proud of it. And he says, people say the Constitution is living, and I say the Constitution is dead, dead, dead. And that gets a lot of applause when he says it. Scalia is really a singular figure, I think, in American law and life, in that most people who get into positions of power, they kind of tone it down and compromise, and they don't really have a coherent point of view. He brought in a very coherent point of view and stuck with it. He did not actually, one of the things that's striking about that Heller case was it was the first time he got to write a big opinion after decades on the court, because he would so anger the other justices that they wouldn't let him write the majority opinion for fear that it would drive away the other justices. This is according to all his biographers. And Chief Justice Rehnquist wouldn't let him do it. His argument for originalism was that it was a way to limit the discretion of judges, to keep judges, modern judges, from imposing their own political views on the Constitution. A lot of people, including other conservatives, looked at the Heller case and thought that that was exactly what he was doing. Judge Richard Posner is one of the leading conservative judges in the United States. He was the originator, he's from the University of Chicago, the originator of law and economics, and he was considered the great, one of the great conservative legal minds. He said that the originalism in Heller merely proved the ability of well-staffed courts to engage in constitutional historical snow jobs, was his words. And then Scalia and him really fought it out, and Scalia called him a liar, and they had blogs. And it's a good, fortunately, they did not have guns. So another judge, Harvey Wilkinson, who was almost appointed to the court by George W. Bush, has been, again, scathing about this question because he thought that this was as loose and political an opinion as Roe versus Wade, which to them, you know, was exactly what they were fighting against. You know, the original intent, the original meaning is really important. First of all, the text is really important. If it says you can only be president when you're 35, it's kind of hard to argue that that means something different now. It means 35. Other parts of the Constitution are either vague, like the 14th Amendment, or confusing, like this one, or self-contradictory. So we've always looked at original intent, but then we've looked at other things too. We've looked at the history since then. We've looked at how the country has changed and evolved. Back then, there was no police force. There were no cities. There were no assault weapons that could have 100 rounds at once. How have things changed? How have they evolved? And what is the meaning and the structure of the government and the structure of the Constitution? This is how most of these decisions get made. A good recent example, just at the very end of this term, was on the kind of obscure issue of whether presidents get to make recess appointments when Congress is out of session. And the question is, when is Congress out of session? And Scalia was angrily dissented and used dictionaries and the whole same thing, but the majority looked at not only what they meant then, but the subsequent 250 years of practice. And that was what was not really, I would argue, not really done right in that opinion. But the holding was not necessarily ultimately inconsistent with both there being a right and there being gun laws, which is in fact more like what has happened since then.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. He was a speechwriter for President Bill Clinton from 1995 to 1999. His latest book is The Second Amendment, a biography. If you enjoyed tonight's talk, you'll find it and many more on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. We post each new episode on the Friday following the broadcast. Thanks again to Town Hall Seattle and Anna Tatashev for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.
Less than a minute before 10, KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham. I'm Bill O'Grady. Washington voters turned out in large numbers when the marijuana legalization initiative was on the ballot, but this week nearly 70% of Seattle voters did not vote in Tuesday's primary. Michael Alvarez is trying to change that. He's a professor of political science at California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, in Pasadena. Alvarez is looking at ways to make voting easier and more convenient. We'll hear him talk about it on the next edition of KUOW's The Record tomorrow at noon. Support for KUOW comes from Delta Airlines, introducing 4 daily nonstop flights from Seattle to San Jose. Service may be operated by Delta Connection Carriers. Delta, keep climbing. 94.9 KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.